And you then having to have all of these institutions and structures in place in order to deal with this terrifying threat, a bit like the war on terror was there to sort of deal with this terrifying threat of Islamic fundamentalist terrorism and so on. So you create these monsters and so on. And then you have these regimes, these structures of control built around it, biosecurity regimes, which, you know, as with the World Economic Forum Great Reset, this is all orientated towards increasing control over populations. Centralizing power, concentrating power. It's all anathema to democracy, obviously. And I think a lot of that goes to potentially explaining COVID-19 as a structural deep event, explaining the why did this occur?
Very warm welcome to Dr. Piers Robinson. Thanks for coming here and taking the time for a talk.
It's good to be with you.
I'd like to introduce you to the audience. You are a political scientist and currently a co-director of the Organization for Propaganda Studies, co-editor of Propaganda in Focus, and research director and board member of the International Center for 9/11 Justice. So obviously you have a lot to do with propaganda. And this is also the topic I would really like to dive into with you, which is propaganda. I'd like to focus on the COVID-19 response, but not totally. And would like to start with this term propaganda or the use of propaganda, because most people I would talk to, they would basically deny the use of propaganda in our Western liberal free democracies that have abandoned these things and only bad regimes do propaganda. So is that, are you saying or your research is saying that even in our Western liberal democracies, propaganda is happening all the time, or in to which degree?
Well, absolutely. Propaganda is a core feature of liberal democracies. One of the reasons why propaganda has, as it were, been erased from the mind of liberals in liberal democracies is this, it was essentially rebranded in the 20th century, and it was rebranded by Eddie Bernays, one of the leading theorists and thinkers regarding propaganda. And he rebranded it as public relations. And I think the exact phrase is, he said that the Germans gave propaganda a bad name because of the way they used it or exploited it in World War One. Mm. So we had to come up with a new name. And the name was Council for Public Relations. And so essentially what people in the West think of as public relations or strategic communication and so on, or political communication, the actual objective history of those activities were historically called propaganda. It's about persuading, manipulating people. And so it's been essentially taken out of our sort of thinking and associated, of course, as you suggested, with, okay, propaganda is something which authoritarian states do. The Soviet Union is something which you see perhaps in wartime in history, in the First and the Second World War, in situations of total war, etc. But it's not something which happens around here and so on. So it's thoroughly pushed to the margins in terms of people's understanding. But the reality is that public relations, one of the biggest industries in the West, public relations grew out of propaganda. And, you know, there is a deeper historical history to propaganda. Of course, a term came from the Vatican, and it was about propagation of the Catholic faith. Okay. So it's about persuasion and so on. And there is a school of thought which says that, well, any form of persuasion is propaganda. It's just propagating ideas, etc. But at least during the 20th century, the general understanding of propaganda is that it's not just persuasion, it's also manipulation. You're getting people to act in particular ways or to believe certain things in a way that they're not fully consenting to that process. So you might be deceiving people, or you might be incentivizing people, bribing, or you might even be coercing people to act in particular ways. And so it's primarily a manipulative phenomenon. And so on. Mm. But it is, it's a core feature of Western liberal democracies. It's been there throughout the 20th century. And of course, in the early part of the 20th century, thinkers such as Laswell and Eddie Bernays, they saw it as a positive element of democracy. They didn't believe in full democracy. Publics had to be led and so on. You needed the intelligent manipulation of the mind, as Eddie Bernays described. And it's essentially an elitist interpretation of democracy. Democracy's okay, but you need to control populations as well to get it to work. And to do that, you do need to manipulate people. You need to push and cajole people into behaving and acting in certain ways. Mm. So it's integral to the functioning of democracy. So the thinking goes. But we have today huge industries now which run throughout the West. We see it in the realm of war. And of course, with COVID-19, we've seen propaganda in large volumes in relation to the alleged public health crisis.
And so the question that comes to my mind is, if most people wouldn't agree on that, then there must be a way to hide the manipulation that you talked about for the public. How does this work? Like, how is it hidden to most people that there's actually manipulation propaganda going on? How can it be hidden?
Well, I mean, in the first instance, you call it by something else. You call it public relations. So you create these very sanitized terms and so on. But another way in which I guess the principal way in which propaganda works and so on in terms of getting people to buy into what they're being told is that people are simply unaware of these processes. Mm-hmm. They're unaware of the degree of intentional manipulation of information that goes on within government. Okay. So these things have to happen behind, as it were, closed doors and so on. And in that way, populations are simply, they listen to a government minister speaking, or they listen to a read a press release and so on. And they think that, well, this is the government just telling me how the world is. They're telling me about the latest health crisis or environmental issue, et cetera, and so on. And it's just their genuine reflecting what the science is telling them or what their experts are telling them. But in reality, and this was in a sense a key moment for me as a researcher, as an academic, was looking at the intelligence around the invasion of Iraq in 2023. And for a long time, I was very conscious that, the claims they seem to be making are incorrect and so on. But maybe they made a mistake and so on. Maybe their intelligence was telling them something different. But in the years after the invasion of Iraq, there were many inquiries in Britain, the Chilcot inquiry, the Hutton inquiry, and a lot of information came out into the public domain. And it actually showed, effectively, all of the kind of decision making that was going on within the British government apparatus in order to present Iraq as a credible threat in terms of weapons of mass destruction.
Exactly.
And you go through all of these documents, it's going back a year prior to the invasion of Iraq and so on. And then you see the actual language being used by the officials talking about the need to sort of disguise certain facts which were inconvenient for the government's case and so on, with people from the intelligence services, the spin doctors, all involved in many, many meetings and so on. And then you suddenly realize that this is the degree of manipulation of information that's going on. Just to make one simple point to the British public is that Iraq is a credible WMD threat, which of course it wasn't, and they knew that it wasn't, and so on. So I think it's, one of the ways it functions is to make sure that these processes are essentially opaque and non-transparent to the public. People don't see what's going on and so on. All they see are the claims, the apparently authoritative claims being made and so on, but they don't see the networks and the structures behind that which go to create that information in the first instance.
Mm. And that is, basically almost a perfect entry to the COVID-19 topic, which I will get to later, because here in this room we published protocols and minutes and data that shows exactly what you are talking about. We're going to do that later. Now, you talked about the Iraq war. I think there was also this moment where Colin Powell showed this white powder somewhere. I think that was part of the story. But were there other prominent examples of propaganda that you would name that are really important, or that were obvious, or that maybe moved you, or you realized, oh, these are really important propaganda moments in the last years or decades besides the Iraq war?
Well, the Iraq war was certainly very important, and is partly because I was research focused on it at the time and so on. So I was digging into it in a lot of detail, etc. I think that there were other sort of moments in my time. So when I was working at University of Manchester, for example, I became more aware and conscious of issues surrounding the JFK assassination. And, you know, for a long time I'd had it blocked off as, well, this is the crazy conspiracy territory and so on. And you don't pay any attention to it. But then I started to become aware that there was a lot of evidence and a lot of research out there showing that the official claims that Lee Harvey Oswald, the lone gunman, etc., simply wasn't correct. And then I think around 2012, I became sort of well-versed enough in that literature to realize, okay, the official story isn't true. Mm. And so that was important because that made it very clear in my mind, that, okay, we have a deception over Iraq and WMD, so a government has lied to take us to war. Perhaps not so surprising for many people in international relations scholarship, governments lie, as Mearsheimer says, and so on. So, but this was something different with JFK because this was a government actually lying, deceiving, yeah, in relation to the assassination of a president.
Yeah.
You don't get bigger than that in political terms. So that was an important moment in becoming aware that, well, actually, okay, governments are willing to carry out these kind of acts of harm or attacks, state crimes against democracy, as Lance de Haven Smith describes them, against our own system. Mm. And of course, this is sort of full of propaganda. The events themselves are essentially propaganda events, as we'll talk about when we get to COVID-19 and so on. And so it's recognition of the reality of the JFK or what it looked like evidence-wise, what had actually happened, I think sort of really opened the door to me to understand, well, okay, we have a problem with overreaching PR industry, i.e. propaganda, but we also have a problem with, as state crimes against democracy. We have problems with nefarious illegal actions being carried out by our own governments against us, against our democracies and so on, not just for pursuit of war against another country and so on. And I think that was a big eye-opener for me. And I think it opened the way for me to think more critically about 9/11, for example. And certainly when COVID-19 started, I could see all the warning signs. Mm. They were very clear to me when that initiated.
And when you studied as a researcher, as a scientist, you studied these events, was it already connected to threats or, I don't know, accusations when you studied, for example, the Iraq war at the university, if I understand it right?
Against me?
Yeah, exactly, because you actually dive into these events and maybe you shouldn't because people don't want to hear that story. Was that a problem back then?
Well, it starts to be a problem because obviously when we talk about propaganda is multifaceted, and I give a very sort of narrow answer to your question about sort of why do people buy into it. But academia itself is caught up in propaganda, in the production of propaganda, and also with propagandists within it and so on as well. So, you know, you have these actors who are there to manipulate and distort information operating in multiple spheres. And within academia, I mean, setting that aside for a moment, within academia, you have this kind of sort of notion and this discourse surrounding conspiracy theory.
Exactly.
And so on. And of course, academia as a discipline tends to be very risk averse, as well as it being very hierarchical and so on. But what tends to happen there is that anyone who's seen as sort of talking about particularly controversial issues, which might get bad publicity and so on, you know, you start to feel cold winds blowing and so on. Now, I didn't get this initially when I was looking at the Iraq invasion, but I did notice in 2002, I edited a special issue of the Review of International Studies, and we had, it's all about Noam Chomsky and the marginalization of Noam Chomsky and so on from international relations scholarship. And we were saying that, look, Chomsky has a point. Okay, in relation to media bias, in relation to propaganda in the West, and we should take seriously his contribution to international relations scholarship. And so we did a big special issue on that, and that came out in 2002. And at that point, I noticed some sort of colleagues around me sort of warning me. I remember very clearly a very senior professor warning me, saying that that's a very good special issue, and I'm glad you said that because it's important for you to point out that Chomsky is being unfairly marginalized and so on. I appreciate that Chomsky has questions about him today over COVID-19, but No, this is in relation to foreign policy back in 2002. And he said that there's going to be a response to this at some point. You're going to feel pressure and pushback. So as a young academic, sort of at the start of my career, thinking about promotion, wanting to get on, it was signaled to me very, very clearly that it's good that you've spoken the truth here through this special issue. But there's going to be a response at some point. So I started to feel this kind of the sense of, okay, this is, you walk in these territories where you're talking about essentially political corruption, deception, and so on. You're walking in territories where your path is going to be more difficult. Mm. Okay. I managed to keep on getting promoted up, and then I got to a full professorship at Sheffield. I think it became most clear when I initially said something about 9/11. And what I said about 9/11 was this. I referenced in a tweet a study by Professor Halsey at Alaska Fairbanks University about the destruction of Building 7, the third building which mm-hmm. fell on 9/11.
Not hit by a plane.
It wasn't hit by a plane.
Yeah.
So, and I simply mentioned this in a tweet, and I just said to somebody, look, I think I'll wait for the outcome of Halsey's study before passing judgment on Building 7. Mm. And almost immediately, I had Oliver Cam from the Times of London, a prominent columnist, attacking me over social media, over Twitter, over X, as it's now known. And he was demanding, and I have this all screenshotted, and it will form the basis of an article at some point. This man is very litigious, by the way, if you're worried about these things. And he was demanding to see the reading lists of my courses that I taught at Sheffield in case I was trying to foister this 9/11 trutherism onto my students. Absolutely amazing. So then I started to realize, well, okay, this is interesting. So I say one thing on social media, and there I've got a columnist from the Times of London attacking me and so on over social media, but copying in my university. And, I think at that point, I think sort of then you start to feel the cold winds blowing slightly stronger within the academic environment, sort of people starting to become aware that you have questions about an issue, entirely legitimate, and so on. And you can start to feel, okay, maybe my journey down this road is going to get harder and harder, and so on. Mm. And so that was around 2015, 2016. But then, to use a proverbial saying, the shit hit the fan in 2018 when I was working on Syria with a group of academics. And we essentially stumbled all over an MI6 deception operation in Syria in relation to alleged chemical weapons. And we were on the front page of the Times of London. We were being attacked. Questions were being asked of me within the academic setting and so on. And from there on in, my life has been sort of one which has been dominated by a lot of attacks. Mm. A lot of people still supporting me from within the academy, but still a lot of attacks going on, media attacks, etc., tendentious editing Wikipedia pages and so on. And that's when, I've certainly been feeling the full force of, what happens as an academic when you come up against power and significant power who've got something to hide. In this case, it's the chemical weapons issue in Syria. But of course, many other academics in the realm of 9/11, in the realm of JFK research, in the realm of COVID-19 have suffered similar kind of smear campaigns and attempts to discredit, etc. And so I think for me, it's become more and more intense over time. Basically attempts just to close down, to stop you talking about the things which you think should be spoken about. Mm.
Just some quick questions from me, because if I remember right, the term conspiracy theorist was actually came into place, was created, whatever, around the JFK assassination. Isn't that correct?
Yeah. I mean, it's a very interesting history. This is Lance de Haven Smith's work on this is seminal. I mean, Okay, first and foremost, conspiracy is a legal term. Okay, to be clear, you know, sort of we prosecute people for conspiracy to murder, and so on. So it's a technical term, and so on. But you're correct. In the 1960s, there is a famous, I think, CIA memo, and it talks about trying to deal with the deliberate dissent over the JFK assassination. And one recommended strategy was to sort of basically bracket anyone raising questions as a conspiracy theorist.
Exactly.
And so on. So it was taking, in a sense, a legal term and then making it a pejorative term to try and suggest that this is just a theory. There's no evidence. It's conspiracy. And of course, that was associated with, you know, this is slightly crazy, wacky ideas and so on. It's a pathological thing. People who are just, have a conspiratorial mind and who are paranoid, et cetera. And so that kind of baggage was attached to conspiracy theory. And then, as you correctly say, is effectively weaponized. And you see a sharp uptick in the use of the term conspiracy theory in mainstream media reporting. And it was at that point sort of established as a clear propaganda weapon to shut people up. So you ask any serious question of power and so on, raising questions about maybe criminal action or nefarious intent, and you're accused of being a conspiracy theorist, a crazy, wacky, unevidenced set of claims, etc.
So. And, I mean, decades later, it's still working. That's what I find astonishing.
Yeah, it's still there. But, of course, I mean, I'd argue, one of my colleagues, Mark Crispin Miller, the American professor, you know, is that it has less currency today.
Yeah.
More people have woken up to it.
Yeah.
And I do think, you know, that there's probably a story there in terms of the rise of the fake news disinformation terminology, which, of course, is what dominates a lot of research and scholarship at the moment, disinformation, etc. So that was, a realization that, well, okay, conspiracy theory isn't working anymore, so we'll call it something else, disinformation. Rather than the same way that Eddie Bernays realized that, well, propaganda's got a bad name, so we'll call it, etc. So you just rebrand. So I think disinformation. So I think it has less traction than it used to have in the past, but it's still there and it's still used and it's still, in a sense, the default go-to for, you know, a politician who's accused of something. He'll say, "Oh, that's just conspiracy theory." Yeah. Or she will say, "That's just conspiracy theory."
I mean, you know, it's funny because I think 2 days, I don't know what exactly, but it was 2 days or 1 day before the first German lockdown, where the minister, the Ministry for Health, I think, I don't remember, said, don't believe in those conspiracy theories of a nationwide lockdown. And then, you know, 2 days later, it was. But before we go into COVID-19, just also for the audience, you talked about Syria and chemical weapons. Not everybody is familiar with that. If I remember right, like the narrative was Assad did a chemical weapons attack on his own people, I think.
Yeah.
And can you say maybe in 2 sentences what actually happened?
Okay, 2 sentences.
Maybe three.
That's a challenge. No, okay. So the big picture with the Syria chemical weapons issue is that these are, propaganda events. A narrative has been constructed using real attacks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But carried out by opposition groups and used to frame the Syrian government. And that was going on for a very long time. I ended up researching that, and then at a point in 2019, two scientists from within the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, who were tasked with investigating these alleged attacks, essentially blew the whistle on the corruption of their investigation. And they said that it was being corrupted to point the finger at the Syrian government, when in fact the blame was lying somewhere else. So they confirmed the research that we had been doing. And for the last 5 years, I've been working with Jose Bastani, the first Director General of the OPCW, Hans von Sponeck, former Assistant Secretary General to the UN, who resigned over the sanctions policy, and also Professor Richard Falk, representing the OPCW scientists, and the truth that they told about the chemical weapons in Syria. That's a potted short version of everything there. But just to give people an idea that this is still an ongoing issue,
mm-hmm.
The people involved in that and so on. So this wasn't my sort of conspiratorial academic frame of mind and so on. You know, these are real scientists from within the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, essentially blowing the whistle on what had been going on and so on. So, but yes, I've been accused of being a conspiracy theorist in relation to that many, many, many times, even when the scientists emerged.
Sure, but
is this still a conspiracy when scientists have come out?
Yeah.
Surely, you know.
Sometimes you have to check if it's still a conspiracy theory or if it's already valid, if you don't know.
Yeah.
And that brings me to COVID-19, because I read, the first things I read from you were in the COVID era. We just had this term, COVID era. And you published a paper called Cock Up or Conspiracy? I think. Understanding COVID-19 as a structural deep event. And that term was new to me, but then I read the paper and I understood the concept. But it would be great for me to hear, what is a structural deep event? Mm. How's that defined, roughly?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, there are two stories on propaganda and COVID-19. And I think there is this question of the early propaganda and the exaggeration and so on. But we can certainly start with a structural deep event, which in a sense is looking at COVID-19 at a much deeper level in terms of propaganda and so on, that the event itself is propaganda. It's not true and so on. Which is fine, but. So on the structural deep event, so a structural deep event is essentially, it's an idea which was, it was an idea which was written about by, Peter Dale Scott, an American professor, and he's a historian, and he had examined the JFK assassination, for example. He'd looked at various, examples from US history, foreign policy history, of essentially nefarious illegal activity going on and so on. And he came up with the term structural deep event to capture the idea of when you have events which are either instigated or very deliberately exploited by actors, deep state actors, i.e. not sort of, you know, elected officials, but actually people within the machinery of government, the deep state, instigate or exploit events in order to create broad scale structural changes in a society. Okay. So he points to the JFK assassination as an example of this. He says that, you know, there were clearly nefarious deep state actors involved in the assassination of JFK. It was not Lee Harvey Oswald as a lone gunman carrying this out. And it was an event designed to try to make sure that the US would continue on its course in relation to the Cold War, that there would not be the kind of redistribution of wealth that John F. Kennedy was calling for within American society. People have pointed out recently the connection with Israel and Israeli nuclear bomb development, etc., and Kennedy's opposition to that. And so the idea is he had sort of multiples of very powerful actors with a big incentive to get rid of John F. Kennedy because they wanted to maintain, you know, the structure of the Cold War, etc., and various related foreign policy objectives as part of that, as well as, the, in a sense, the economic structure within the US to keep that intact or to maintain the status quo and so on. So the assassination becomes this structural deep event. It's carried out by deep state actors. It's there to try to maintain or to, you know, to underpin broad scale policies, which of course, you know, maintenance of the Cold War structured our lives for a very, very long period of time. You and I, as we were growing up and so on, were children of the Cold War and so on. It shaped almost every aspect of our lives and so on. So that's the idea behind structural deep events. And of course, you know, you can apply it to 9/11. 9/11 is an event which involved deep state actors. You know, the evidence that it was an Al-Qaeda operative who carried out the attack is minimal. The evidence that this was a deep state operation by the US government and allies is very, very strong. In fact, overwhelming. But it was an event, which was then used in order to initiate the global war on terror and the multiple regime change wars that we saw in the international system and which we continue to see to this day. And so it's a structural deep event. It's there to create or underpin a new set of wars, which are ultimately all about maintenance of American hegemony and so on. With deep state, in fact, deep state actors involved, with large amounts of propaganda around it, but also the event itself is essentially a propaganda event. It's there to, in that case of 9/11, to mobilize the American public into supporting, when you think about it, a huge number of wars in the international system: Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, list goes on. And obviously Iran is still very much in the crosshairs and so on. So this is how you can understand 9/11 as a structural deep event. Mm-hmm. So that's I think hopefully I've communicated clearly enough the sort of the basic ideas of it.
Yeah, for me, because for me it was important to basically prepare or to learn how you look at things, and like with this concept of a structural deep event, with this concept of propaganda. And because whenever I sit here with people now, I sit here with doctors, with research experts, with scientists, especially from the medical field. And when then COVID-19 came, they looked at this event from their perspective. So an immunologist looks at it this way, and we had people from different aspects. And they all look at COVID-19, of course, with their expertise, which is not, that's their right. It's obviously good. But then I wanted to know, now COVID-19 comes, basically, and you, with your knowledge, with your expertise on propaganda, you have that, propaganda maybe is the word, but you have all this attention coming up, all these pictures and all these outlets are pushing the story. What was your initial reaction? And now 5 years later, what do you think of it now? Because you had this question in your paper, like cock up or conspiracy. Maybe you can answer it now, but maybe first, what was your first initial reaction?
Well, I mean, this brings this point that I made just before we started talking about structural deep events, is that when you talk about the doctors, you know, there is this component of COVID-19 where, you know, sort of the doctors and the scientists who you've been interviewing will certainly agree with it. This was being exaggerated. It's inaccurate and so on. Yes, there was a lot of propaganda surrounding it and so on. But that always still leaves you as this possibility, sort of, you know, is this a panicked overreaction to something where they think, got to use lots of propaganda to scare people because it's really scary, or is there actually a bigger lie going on, i.e. is this a structural deep event and so on. So, but certainly in the early days of COVID-19, before I'd started to really sort of, well, I mean, early on, I thought this looks very similar to 9/11. A lot of the features we saw in 9/11 and JFK, we can see here with COVID-19. But I was willing to just resist that temptation, at least initially, with COVID-19. But it was very apparent that they were engaging in propaganda to exaggerate the fear levels, make people scared of something, willing to go with the idea that perhaps they believe there's something genuinely dangerous out there, etc. And we need to, you know, people are lazy. We just need to scare them a bit to make sure that they're properly protected. And this was pretty clear, I think, early on, for as somebody who's studied propaganda, that you could see it in the kind of style of media reporting. And in fact, early on in the UK context, I know you've had, is it the panic papers in Germany came out? But in the UK, it's very early on. I think it was May of 2020. A group of behavioral scientists who work for the government, some of their advice to the government actually went into the public domain. And it talked about the need to raise perception of fear and to raise fear levels and to use media. And also talked about the need to engage in sort of strategies of incentivization and coercion to get people to comply with non-pharmaceutical interventions like distancing and so on. And, you know, the media was full of this material coming out from these behavioral scientists on how to manipulate people, make people very scared. And that was very, very clear early on. I'm trying to think of some of the kind of phrases which were being used. You know, granny killer. If you don't follow the masking and so on, then you'll become a granny killer. And there are these very emotive, provocative posters from the National Health Service being put out and so on, with a picture of an old lady, etc. So, you know, this is pretty powerful propaganda and so on, trying to mobilize people to comply with, you know, essentially all the restrictions which are being placed to comply with lockdown, etc. And so I think that was, you know, I was very confident very early on with COVID-19 that They're definitely exaggerating this. Could still be because they genuinely believe there's something really, really dangerous, and they just don't think people will sort of comply sufficiently. So they have to engage in this exaggeration.
Yeah.
So it's propaganda, but you can still make the case that perhaps, given the circumstances, an emergency health crisis, a new, really dangerous virus, maybe it's the kind of times that justifies propaganda. Okay, fair enough, and so on. The other component, and this is where it really started to bite with me, that okay, this is getting quite extreme was when they started censoring the scientists. And of course, early on, I mean, in Germany, you had Bakhti, Ioannidis in the US. You then had later in 2020, you had people like Jay Bhattacharya and Martin Kulldorff and so on, all very prominent scientists, some of them epidemiologists. And they were essentially contradicting what the governments were saying and so on. But these scientists were very quickly smeared. And you could see that there were decisions made by YouTube, for example. I recall one of them was that they would sort of be removing any interviews with these people from the platform, etc. And so there you have, you know, this is the two, there are two sides to propaganda. One is the promotion of making people scared. And the other thing is silencing dissent. Mm. So arguably that's the bigger part of any propaganda campaign, is creating the silences to stop people, alternative narratives from emerging. But that, of course, you know, was very, very important. It was a big wake-up call for any sort of student of propaganda, is that now they're actually censoring people. And it's not just sort of your usual suspects of, you know, crazy conspiracy theorists. These are all high status scientists in top institutions who are clearly taking a lot of risk for their careers.
Death threats. They all became death threats. They all received death threats.
And so on. So you have that sort of tactic being used against them. So of course, we don't know quite where those death threats came from and so on, but who knows at the end of the day if this is a structural deep event with deep state actors involved. Mm. But just the fact that you have people of that prominence being smeared. And I remember thinking at the time, I was thinking, well, you know, me and my colleagues studying Syria and the war in Syria and propaganda, which most of the public don't really care about. And we're sort of social scientists, and people can easily dismiss social scientists and so on. Here you have these sort of, you know, scientists from sort of, you know, the medical sciences, et cetera, speaking out, which, you know, ultimately is respected in a way that social sciences, I think, aren't respected by a lot of the public and so on. It's like, wow, this is pretty serious propaganda at work here, that they're having to shut these people up. And that's when I think it really solidified in my mind that there's something else going on here. That this is not a straightforward medical emergency, health crisis, which the government is then trying to desperately respond to. This is a very coordinated and it's very directed, and they're trying to close down reasoned academic scholarly debate on this issue with top scientists. So there's something else going on. And that's when I think, you know, but by the end of the summer, when I know I was in contact with a colleague of mine, actually, who worked in Syria, an epidemiologist, was saying that, don't worry, they've overreacted. As soon as we get through this initial phase, they'll see the figures, the stats, and then the panic will be over. They'll recognize that they got it wrong. And I was sort of going with that for a while into the summer of 2020. Well, maybe my colleague is correct here and so on. And, they will suddenly realize it's a huge cock up, but it's when everything continued, even when, you know, more and more evidence was accumulating that, okay, this virus is not of the form that they're claiming it to be and so on. And then we were going back into the autumn of 2020 with more lockdowns. Mm-hmm. Yep. And I thought, this isn't a response to a health crisis. You know, this is not a cock-up anymore. There's something else going on. And that's where I think, you know, and many other people were looking at this. This is a political event and so on. This is being either exploited, i.e. it's real, or it's essentially instigated. There's not really a novel, particularly dangerous virus in circulation. They're creating the impression of that, and they're doing that for reasons which are essentially opaque and so on. And I think so by that point, I was moving well into territory of, yep, there's lots of propaganda, but no, this is also a structural deep event. This is a big lie. This is a big deception that we're seeing with COVID-19.
Mm. And I just said, for reasons that are hidden. So 5 years later, now looking back on it, what really happened if it wasn't a health crisis, and what were the reasons that were hidden?
Well, I think, I mean, in the paper that I wrote with Kevin Ryan on understanding COVID-19 and 9/11 as structural deep events. I think our starting point was, you know, okay, if you look at the science, and I know you've interviewed a lot of scientists, and I won't sort of go into that territory in relation to this too much, but, you know, it has become very, very apparent if you look at the work of, for example, Denis Rancourt, Jessica Hockett, Jonathan Engler with Panda, that, and also Stefan Homburg, of course, here in Germany and so on, is that sort of the stats don't show a dangerous spreading virus. What they show is an uptick in fatalities, for example, after they lock down and declare. So you had this whole idea of iatrogenic harms. So people were being killed by the treatments which were being employed. But what you don't see in all of this, to cut a long story short, you don't see sort of, you know, an emerging virus with sort of spikes in people dying and so on and building over time. It's just, there's nothing there. And then suddenly a declaration and you see this huge spike, et cetera. Mm. And so on. So the stats didn't make any sense and so on as to this, the allegation or the claim that there was this major health crisis occurring, etc., and that many people were dying from it, and so on. So I think the science was becoming pretty clear, and I think now that's very well documented. Although it still appears to be an uphill struggle getting enough mainstream scientists to acknowledge these basic facts and so on, but leave that battle to people like Denis Rancourt, who's doing a very good job, I think, in terms of getting the information out there into the public domain. Mm. I think in terms of of what this was really about, if this wasn't a response to a major health crisis, I mean, you know, we set out in the paper we wrote that there are three broad arguments which we can see in a sense for literature or the dissident literature, whatever you want to call it. One argument, of course, is that, you know, that it's a structural deep event and it was designed to introduce a whole range of major structural changes to Western democracies in particular. So you have the whole Build Back Better, the World Economic Forum, etc., all of these ideas about trying to the Great Reset, trying to restructure our society. And along with that, you can see, you know, throughout early on with COVID-19, you can see discussion about central bank digital currency, you can see discussion about digital ID, you can see discussions about some digitized society, etc. And of course, you know, this is, you know, quite well documented now by people sort of across the dissident sphere. You know, these are concrete, real strategies, policies, which they were trying to implement and to take advantage of COVID-19 in order to do that. So, of course, you had the famous Klaus Schwab from the World Economic Forum. You know, he wrote his book, The Great Reset, within a couple of months of COVID-19 occurring. And he talks about COVID-19 being this narrow window opportunity to create all of these changes. So there you have, you know, a lot of evidence that sort of, you know, a variety of political actors and networks, power networks, essentially were seeing or were using COVID-19 in order to restructure society, essentially in a direction of greater control for authorities. Central bank digital currency, digital IDs, etc., let alone requiring people to take an injection every 6 months, which was the original plan, of course. You know, this is all, you know, essentially biosecurity regime, getting control on people, getting control in society and so on. And I think, you know, that there's a lot of evidence in support of that as an explanation for why COVID-19 was turned into the health crisis that it was, etc. You then have, and this dovetails with that, is really sort of Paul Schreier's done a very good work on this in terms of, you know, the broader biosecurity regime. That, you know, you go back to the 1990s and you can see the sort of development of essentially a discourse around ideas of biological weapons, either real or man-made or naturally occurring, being a catastrophic threat to human society. And you then having to have all of these institutions and structures in place in order to deal with this terrifying threat, a bit like the war on terror was there to sort of deal with this terrifying threat of Islamic fundamentalist terrorism and so on. So you create these monsters and so on. And then you have these regimes, these structures of control built around it, biosecurity regimes, which, you know, as with the World Economic Forum Great Reset, this is all orientated towards increasing control over populations, centralizing power, concentrating power. It's all anathema to democracy, obviously. And I think a lot of that goes opposed to potentially explaining COVID-19 as a structural deep event, explaining the why did this occur? Mm. Another set of arguments, of course, I mean, you're familiar with Fabio Vigi's work on this. He and others have pointed out that there's also an economic dimension to COVID-19, that there was an economic crisis in the autumn of 2019, a crisis in the repo markets, which demanded a massive injection of money, creation of money in order to avert a catastrophic meltdown. And of course, the argument goes with that. Is that then action such as lockdown was the necessary step which had to be taken in order to prevent hyperinflation. Mm. So you bailed out the markets. And of course, you know, of course, for some people, this is slightly abstract economics. And I think, well, this is getting well into the conspiracy theory territory. But when you think about the state of Western economies and the finance sector over the last, you know, 20 years, you have the crash in 2007, you have a flatlining of the finance economy since then, and then you have a new emerging crisis in 2019. So you can start to see how this might actually start to make sense, that you then need to create events and crises in order to enable you to manage this crisis that you have in the finance markets and the repo markets and so on. So that's another component. And I think that's probably in the fullness of time, it will become apparent that probably is a part of the explanation for COVID-19. I would add, and I'll emphasize this, and this is what we emphasize in the paper, is that, you know, with 9/11, the proximal explanations for 9/11 are pretty well documented. We know that the neocons and the Project for a New American Century were talking about the need for a new Pearl Harbor. We know that they wanted to go to war against multiple countries in the international system in preparation for fending off Chinese, Russian emergence as new power blocks in 21st century. So we knew there was a clear rationale, and there were completely open about it in the 1990s. And so that's the clear sort of direct explanation for 9/11. It's there to start wars, and it did a very good job at it. It got America into Afghanistan, Iraq, and it carries on through to this day with the current situation in relation to Iran and so on. So that's a clear, well-documented, solid explanation. I think there is also of 9/11 because you had the introduction of the Patriot Act. And of course, 9/11 itself also interfaced with, you know, the anthrax attacks, as Graham McQueen has documented, and so on. So you also, I think, have these elements of trying to get control over populations using these sort of big bogeymen, not just Islamic fundamentalist terrorism, but fear of biological weapons and so on. Mm. And Patriot Act was, of course, suspension of a lot of sort of generally accepted, you know, rights and so on, civil rights, etc. And so that appears to be in a consolidation of political power to the center using 9/11. So I think that's a secondary explanation for 9/11 after the starting the wars and so on. Mm. Well documented. With COVID-19, we're closer to that structural deep event. And I would sort of, you know, gently offer that, okay, it's probably going to be a few more years before more information comes out and we get better clarity on that. I know that there are some people who are very determined to hold to the light that we know exactly who's behind it, what was going on and so on. And fine, you know, people have their various positions and so on. I think the reality is there are probably multiple actors with COVID-19 who had shared interests, maybe cutting across, you know, finance industry through to the biosecurity industrial complex, etc., and possibly a convergence of those actors around, let's create this event at this point in time. So, and these probably have a global component to them as well. It's not just sort of actors within, say, the United States or within Western states. There's probably a global component to this with COVID-19. But I think that the lack of clarity, I would say, is purely a function of how close we are to the event. 9/11, you know, we have a much clearer sort of data base, as it were, of information. Go back to JFK, pretty well documented now what that was all about, as I said at the start of the interview and so on. But, you know, it takes time to all that information to be accumulated and so on, and for you to be able to say with absolute confidence exactly what this is and so on. Mm. So I think that's the case with COVID-19. But I think there is a strong, clear, you know, consensus, at least in terms of people who look at it, is that, yeah, this thing was not what they claimed it to be. It was not a health crisis. It wasn't just a cock-up. It wasn't just an overreaction. This, you had political forces who were driving, creating, instigating this event in order to pursue a variety of policies, some of which I've outlined and so on. That definitely was the case with COVID-19. Exactly where the locus of that power is and exactly, who were the primary drivers, we'll have to wait and see over time.
But that's one point to it that would always come up. If I follow your train of thought, then there would be the question, how do I synchronize all these countries? You know, because whenever I talk about this, I have somebody saying, yeah, but, you know, you couldn't, how would you do that with all these countries? You know, that doesn't work. And how do you react to that point?
Well, I think one of the interesting features of COVID-19, if we, you know, keeping with the structural deep event idea, you know, you move from JFK, obviously a fairly internal US event and so on, although probably with external actors involved in some shape or form, and 9/11, you're talking more about the Western Empire and so on. If this was an imperial, it was a false flag in order to initiate imperial wars, mm-hmm. to maintain dominance, etc. Then it's still pretty much located sort of, you know, within the Western power block. With COVID-19, you're right, it has this global dimension to it. And this has led some people to argue that there actually is a kind of a global level entity, set of organizations who are orchestrating and so on. Now, I don't exclude that as a possibility, okay? I have not personally seen evidence which shows that that's the case. What I would say, and this is an answer to your question about the level of coordination, is that if you look at the key players with the COVID-19 response, you've got the World Economic Forum, you've got the United Nations, you've got the World Health Organization, etc. And then you have, you know, the US authorities, British authorities, European authorities, Germany, etc. Okay, these are all countries which are sort of primarily located within, as it were, what you describe as the Western Empire, or hegemon, whatever terminology you want to use and so on. And then if you look at organizations such as the World Health Organization, these are ultimately very penetrated by Western actors and Western ideology. Same goes for the United Nations, I think, to a very large extent. Back to the Syria and the chemical weapons and the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which I've researched extensively, that is co-opted by Western powers. So a lot of these international organizations, which were essentially key players in creating a global panic over COVID-19, are actually sort of linkable back to power centers in the West and so on. So I think, you know, when you've managed, if you're an empire and you've managed to co-opt these major organizations, okay, then you are actually in a position to, okay, hit the alarm bell, shout fire, shout there's a novel virus spreading, etc. And you have those institutions co-opted and functioning according to what you want to try and push out. And so I think that explains a lot of the coordination. And, you know, I think within that, and this is a caveat I'd introduce, you know, and this is a nod to people who say there's a genuinely global thing going on, is that, you know, I think that the technologies of control, the technocracy, central bank, digital currency, etc., these technologies of control, which actors within the West and within the Western imperial bloc were trying to advance under the cover of COVID-19, all of those technologies are very tempting to countries such as China, mm-hmm. and probably Russia as well. Mm-hmm. You know, big, powerful countries like to get control over their populations and so on. So, you know, there might have been, and I'm speculating here, an element in which, okay, we'll go along with this.
Is there a shared interest?
Because we have a shared interest.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean they're necessarily coordinating with each other. This is like we're trying to control the global population. And I think this is one of the challenges that all of us have at this point in time, is understanding what is actually quite a complex global picture. That we do have these kind of global level actors, whether it's corporations or the global governance structures that we see. But we then also have, you know, countries and power blocks within that framework who clearly there's cooperation sometimes, but there's also conflict. You know, there's very real conflict in the Middle East or in West Asia. There's very real conflict in Gaza, and people are dying every day. Very real conflict in Iran, against Iran, etc. Ukraine as well. These are all real things, and so on. So I think that notion of conflict and cooperation perhaps captures the idea that perhaps, you know, the West was driving this and other states such as China were going along with it, thinking, okay, we can cooperate. Maybe we can gain from this. But that comes to an end at some point. And it's not clear to me that sort of those agendas are being pushed in quite a global way that they were then. And if they are, they could still be being pushed by organizations who continue to be co-opted by the West and so on. So that's how I explain the coordination. And again, the OPCW is a good example, because anyone listening to the pronouncements of the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, you're basically hearing the US, British and French narrative. Yeah, you're not hearing the dissenting scientists. You're not hearing China, Russia, or Brazil. I mean, China tends to be quite polite, just saying we need to start doing these investigations properly, and so on, given everything that's happened, etc. But all you hear is essentially the voice of the Western powers through the OPCW, which is supposed to be, and you know, a UN-linked, independent, gold standard watchdog organization. And it's not. It's co-opted by the West in very significant ways. So it doesn't surprise me you have this with COVID-19 and you have it with the World Health Organization. And just to remind me, who is the biggest donor to the World Health Organization? Bill and Melinda Gates. So, you know, this starts, it helps you to understand how these organizations are corrupted and manipulated and so on.
And coming back to COVID-19, I think we had very good proof here. 1 year ago, we basically published the protocols and minutes of the RKI, which is supposedly or is the state department, you know, about diseases. And there we can read that politicians demanded things from them that were against the evidence, against the recommendation of the scientists. So on a small scale, on a Germany scale, that is proven that. And then politicians, though, claimed to rely on science or listen to science, even though before they listened to science, they said what science had to say. And we know that now for sure. And one thing also in your paper, you call about, you talk about the involvement of deep actors. And I wanted to come to COVID-19 and this question of how is it possible to make this all in sync in a way? And one of the things that, or where's evidence to it, I think, is that in Germany, we could see that people from the military are stepping in and suddenly having very, very important roles when it comes to fighting a new virus, you know, a war on a virus, another war. And we know now from the Netherlands, too, we have statements from officials saying, well, we had to, I cannot quote it perfectly, we had to agree with or we had to go along with principles or aims or things that the NATO wanted. And a lot of people, and to me too, I think it's very intriguing or interesting to look, was the military involved? Was it responsible? Do you have any knowledge about this?
Yes, I mean, this is a relatively short section in the paper that Kevin and I wrote about, okay, the evidence for deep state actors. And I think, I mean, in Germany, it was a member of the Bundeswehr was put in a position of, I think, some sort of department to deal with health emergencies in December, etc. In the US, I think the National Security Council, sort of meetings over COVID were basically restricted from very early on. And so you have all these indicators that, you know, you effectively have this kind of militarized response and so on. And this is an opaque, covert process which is going on. Same goes, I think, over a lot of the kind of debates over the vaccine, in inverted commas, creation and so on. There's sort of this military component and linked to the military industrial complex. I mean, in the UK, you had, for example, the 77th Brigade, who are they're the online warriors of the British military. And basically what they do is they go out there on social media and attack people who are questioning the government and so on. They were operationalized very early on in relation to COVID-19 in order to try and suppress dissenting voices and so on. So, yeah, I think you do. You have a lot of evidence, and I think, you know, the archive obviously showed this kind of political dimension to it. But yeah, you do have this effectively this kind of notion of a militarized response to a health crisis in across the board with COVID-19. And I think this does link into, you know, the idea that we spoke about before in terms of how do we explain this and the whole biosecurity regime, or the biosecurity, industry, military industrial complex, biosecurity industrial complex, which Paul Schreier documented in his book. I think, that is absolutely based upon two notions. One is of naturally occurring bio threats and then man-made bio threats. And this is actually where there's an overlap with my work in chemical weapons and OPCW and so on. There's a huge industry out there of researchers, academics, journalists, writers, et cetera, who are there building this kind of sort of, you know, narrative around these big, scary threats. If it's not a naturally occurring virus, which is going to wipe us all out, like it did in the film, what are the two major films? Is it Outbreak and Contagion, the Hollywood movies?
Yeah.
Those kind of threats. Or it's the Iranians with a nuclear weapon, or it's biological weapons, or it's chemical weapons by Russia and Ukraine, etc. And these are biosecurity industrial complex is an accurate descriptor for the extent and depth of these activities. And so this actually pulls in. So it's securitizing health, basically. Mm. And it's treating it in the same way as you would treat a threat from, an alleged threat from Iran or Russia or North Korea or China. And all of that's in play now politically. We see that, you know, in day-to-day politics at the moment and so on, of this threat creation going on. So in that sense, if we link COVID-19 to that broader biosecurity regime, it's no surprise that it's got this military component, because this is what the whole thing is about. It's about terrifying people and controlling people through two parallel fears and so on. One of man-made biological weapons, chemical, nuclear, and one of naturally occurring. And if you can keep us all and everyone in the world sufficiently terrified of those bogeymen, you've got a lot of power. Mm. And that, in the simplest sense, I think is how this game is being played.
Yeah.
We have a politics of fear, obviously in the West, but also more globally, which is being used to try and control people.
And that seems to me astonishing that most people... Maybe it's not most, but it seems like it. Most people do not understand or realize that there's people out there who want to make them afraid for political reasons, that it is really possible again and again to have people afraid of the next new terrorist, the next new Iran has nuclear bombs. It comes just basically every year or every month, almost there's a new threat. But the dynamic behind it, like from a meta perspective, is always the same. You should be afraid and I have the solution so that you're not afraid. It seems to be very hard to communicate this to people while they are afraid, right?
Well, I think in some ways, you know, people are more awake to this than they have been in the past. And, you know, I mean, just to go back to the kind of specifics of COVID-19, there is an argument to be made, I think, that with COVID-19, they overreached somewhat. That they may try to make people terrified of a virus and so on. They exaggerated the claims, etc. And then they thought they'd have enough control over the information environment to keep that going. But they didn't. People were protesting out on the streets. Here in Germany, we had big protests. In my local part of Berlin, we had Monday night protests, people walking around, breaking lockdown and so on. So they overreached in terms of what they could, amount of control that they could exercise. But also this fear, people with COVID-19, I think, or at least some people started to think, do you know what? Life's too short. Mm-hmm. Even if this thing is real, I'll take the risk. You know, I'd rather have a proper funeral with my grandmother where we can all sit close to each other and so on. Because, you know, we're all going to die anyway. So I think that there was an overreach, and I think that people did, this element of fatigue over, I can't be bothered with being scared anymore. Mm. And I think that's so you're absolutely right to say that a lot of people are still living in fear, but a lot of people have woken up. They've seen this happening again and again. They've seen the global war on terror. Whatever they think about 9/11, they can see what's happening in Syria at the moment, where Gilani, who is formerly HTS, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, etc., prescribed as a terrorist by the State Department, has now been appointed as our new leader.
It's crazy.
So people can start to see this. None of this makes sense anymore. Mm. Our people in control of us, or our leaders, if we want to call them that, have become very adept at scaring us and then, you know, basically inverting reality whenever they want to invert reality, changing who we're going to call a terrorist, etc., clearly manipulating our fears and so on. So I think there's a level of awareness now, and in a sense a level of exhaustion with, I just don't want to be, I'm up with being made afraid,
yeah,
and so on. And I know that's, you know, a lot of people still buy into this, but I think that's bigger now than it's ever been before. And I think this does point to the limits of propaganda. Yeah. Is that, you know, you can go a very long way with propaganda, but you never have total control over people. You never have total control over people's minds, which is why, of course, they end up becoming so coercive, and why I think Western governments at the moment are becoming so coercive. I arrest people for protesting against Israel, for example, all of the European Union Digital Services Act, mm-hmm. trying to sort of get disinformation, fake news sort of banned or made illegal, etc. All of these very coercive strategies just highlight how much control they've ultimately lost over the minds of many people in the West. Mm. And so, you know, I think it's diminishing returns. And I think we're at this point now, we're on the cusp of where are we going to go from here? Is a new structural deep event going to be pulled off? If so, what? We can maybe talk about that. But maybe there's an awareness that, well, even if they do try and pull off another big event, that they won't be able to carry enough of the public with this, because people have woken up because of COVID. You know, there's a lot of discussion about 9/11 now. Mm. You know, in America, you have Ron Johnson, a sitting senator. Yep. You have Kurt Weldon, former congressman, calling for new investigations into 9/11. That's pretty unprecedented. Tucker Carlson talking about it. He's one of the most influential, high profile, obviously influencers, ex-journalists in the US. So you have got this kind of sort of an awakening going on amongst a significant part of the population, which means that I think, you know, I don't think we're going to be stuck in this fear-mongered world forever. Mm. And I think it will break down, but there's going to be underlying this, the need for political change. And we're probably in for a bumpy ride politically for you know, a number of years, maybe decades. Maybe it'll be less than that. Mm. But, you know, but there is a limit to this, and it does come to an end at some point, I think. And I think, yeah, people are waking up.
Mm. I'd like to end with one question regarding COVID-19. We talked about this just earlier before we started recording, that we talked about this thing that some people had high hopes whenever there was, oh, now this study came out, everybody should know, oh, it wasn't that bad. And there was like multiple events where, you know, normally you would say, now this is all over, because it's clear that there is not the threat that they propagate. But if you look at it now, and also with your background to 9/11, which is decades ago, do you see, or how possible do you see it, that the COVID-19 narrative, the official COVID-19 narrative, gets debunked for a majority of society? Do you think that is going to happen? What does it need for that? And question that you can't answer, how long does it take?
Well, okay. What I would say is that people need to keep speaking. I know it's a well-worn phrase, speaking truth to power. People need to keep on saying what they've been saying for a number of years. So the scientists need to keep on speaking out, etc. And it does take time for that to cut through and so on, and for you to get this. What you're alluding to is this kind of this mainstream acceptance. Now, and this is the most straightforward way I can answer this. The JFK assassination was completely shut down, obviously. And you talked about how they weaponized the term conspiracy theory. It's completely shut down for many, many decades. But over time, we're now at a point where you do have mainstream recognition that the official story is not true. And also a lot of prominent people saying the CIA and a number of other actors were involved in assassinating him. And I'd say that you're getting to the beginning of mainstream acceptance, and that's after a very long period of time.
Yes.
But 9/11, I think, you know, we're starting to reach that point, but it's happened quicker. And with COVID-19, if you think 9/11, sort of we're at this point now where we've at least got one senator who's talking about a new inquiry. So after over 20 years since the event occurred, that's quicker than with JFK. Mm-hmm. And with COVID-19, we're just 5 years from this event and so on. And we have, you know, you have a significant movement of dissenting people from the traditional left, a little bit less from the right mainly, but also a little bit from the left as well and so on. But those entities are still there and still pushing back and so on. So I think it will be quicker than 9/11 if we take a line, mm-hmm. and so on. I think it will be quicker with COVID-19. So maybe in 10 years, we'll see the kind of the recognition that we're starting to see now with 9/11 and also going back to JFK in 5-10 years time, I think JFK will be fully accepted. It'll be difficult for anyone not to acknowledge in the mainstream. So there will be an emerging consensus on that. And so I think it will happen quicker. And I think progress is, and I think you can just see from the speed at which things unravel. COVID-19 unraveled much quicker than the global war on terror. Mm-hmm. Okay, global war on terror was kicking off conflicts in the international system for many, many years, and arguably still is in relation to Iran. But with COVID-19, you know, the wheels have come off that in a significant way. People don't take the injection anymore. If they try to lock people down again, they will face a lot of resistance, and more so than last time and so on. So, you know, I think these are all strong indications that their control is weakening. They're certainly not going away. And I mean, these people who rule over us and so on. And we are in for a big fight and a big struggle and so on. But I don't think we're on the winning side ultimately. But it will be quicker. But most importantly, people just need to be prepared for a long, drawn out, sustained war of attrition against, mm-hmm. our corrupted political classes, which is what they are. These are ultimately, underlying all of this is we have a problem with our democracies. They're not democracies. We have a problem with our political classes, that they're not representing our interests and so on. So we have a big political struggle ahead of us, but, you know, we have time on our side, I think, in all of this. And we have a changing world as well. The world is changing. The ability of the West to project power militarily, I think, is over. That era is gone. So we're in a changing world, and with that comes opportunities as well. So I think for all the darkness there is, and I know a lot of people are battle hardened, stroke exhausted and so on, especially with COVID-19, you know, we are making progress, and it's important to almost have a sort of a warrior mentality about this, and just to say, okay, let's just, you know, it's a war of attrition, mm-hmm. and you just keep going and so on, keep doing the things that you're doing and so on. And then in the fullness of time, you know, we will reap the benefits. Maybe it's not apparent to us at the moment and so on, but we will get there in the end.
Mm. Well, I'd like to conclude with those hopeful words. Thanks for coming, and thanks for all the insights you gave.
It's very good being with you. Thank you. And thank you for your work as well.